are going to talk about why so few women, even today, pursue careers in science. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, October 9th. Our guest has a science background. She was one of the first two women to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in physics from Yale. But she did not pursue physics as a career. We'll hear her story and why she's concerned that still today, only one-fifth of physics PhDs in this country are awarded to women, and only half of those women are Americans. And of all the physics professors in the U.S., only 14% are women. Why is this? What do you think? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are very happy to have with us Eileen Pollack. She is a professor of English at the University of Michigan. She is the author of Breaking and Entering and In the Mouth, and she is currently working on her third book about women in the sciences. She's also the writer of a recent piece that we found in the New York Times, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science? Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks a lot for being with us. So why did you pursue science, at least at the college level?
Well, it actually goes back to junior high school. It's a strange story. I actually, when I was in elementary school, I just wanted to be a writer. But it sort of bothered me that people seemed to think that was just a nice thing for girls to do. And then when I was in seventh grade, I went to a small rural public high school, and all of us were given a test in science and math. We didn't know why. And it turned out that they took the few boys who scored highest on the exam and skipped them ahead a year or two because our school didn't have any calculus courses or there was a physics course when you were a senior, but it was a very general sort of watered-down course in physics. So the idea was that the boys would get to go to the community college when they were juniors and seniors, and that would prepare them for college math and science. And I also scored very high, but I wasn't skipped ahead, which was very upsetting, just the idea of it. But also I was already very bored in my math and science classes. So I sent my mother in to ask why, and the principal said that I would just be wasting a seat because girls never went on in science and math, and besides, it would ruin my social life.
Oh, no.
Which I already didn't have, because to be a 12 or 13-year-old girl and to be good in school and good in those courses, you already didn't have much of a social life. So I got angry. It was purely at that point to prove the principle wrong. So I just started reading books about science and math, and I gradually actually stopped going to school. I spent most of my time sitting in my parents' attic reading books about science, and I actually taught myself calculus from a book.
Well, your parents weren't all that thrilled about you pursuing the sciences either, were they?
No, but you know, it wasn't the 1950s, but they were sort of still 1950s parents. I love them dearly, but they just wanted us to take a safe way out, and if you were a girl, it was sort of get an English degree, learn to teach, and be able to support yourself until you got married, and then maybe you could teach again after the kids left home. So my father just didn't really see why a girl would take on sort of the harder subjects if she didn't have to, although he wanted me to be happy. I mean, it was it's a complicated subject. It's not,
right.
You know, it's just not outright. There are no villains really here.
Sure, and you did congratulations, a real pioneer here, earning the second only Bachelor of Science degree in physics from Yale as a woman. You graduated in 1978, but you also you stumbled a little bit, didn't you, during that time?
It was more than a stumble. So I made it to Yale, but I had no idea how far behind I was. So I actually, when I started out, there had been no women to major in physics, or at least to go for a bachelor of science. So my first class was 118 guys and me and one other woman, and I didn't realize they had, almost all of them had been to sort of fancy private schools and magnet schools like Bronx High School of Science, and they had taken a year or two of college physics before that point, and they had had a year or two of college calculus in high school, and I had had none of the science and taught myself, you know, the math from a book, which gives you a pretty shaky foundation. And so from the first day in our physics class, I knew I was in way over my head. I was terrified. I got a 32 on my first physics exam and actually went in to drop both the course and the major. And I had a wonderful professor that year, and he wouldn't let me drop. But it was a terrible struggle to catch up. It was exhausting. And, you know, in the context of being the only girl in pretty much any of my classes, science classes, so that, you know, even if I thought of raising my hand to ask a question, I would also think, well, no, I won't do that, because then they'll think the one dumb girl in the class is slowing down the pace. And then I would miss even more, because thinking that, you know, I'd lose even more sense of the lecture. So it was a terrible struggle right through.
And while this professor was encouraged you to stick with the class that you were struggling in, and nobody had, you know, maybe done that before, he also did not encourage you to move on to get a graduate degree in.
Well, it was interesting, because I kind of overshot the mark. You know, when you come in behind and you get very determined, I ended up passing the guys who had come in with the head start. What the great advice this professor gave me was, he had been a swimmer, and he said, you just don't look at the people in the other lane, that slows you down, just swim in your own lane. So I just swam in my own lane, and by junior year, I was way ahead of almost everybody else. I had done original research, I had taken advanced, even graduate level courses, and even though I realized I was not good in the lab, although that was also for reasons having to do with being the only woman in the room and not having that kind of a background, I found out I was very good at sort of the more theoretical branches of physics, quantum mechanics, cosmology, and those were the fields I wanted to go in on. And not only was I wouldn't say I was actively discouraged, but I thought if I was good enough, somebody would have said, are you going on in this? No one did. And that one professor, who I think is a wonderful man and in many ways encouraged me, but it's just the ethos in the field, even for men, really, that if you need encouragement to go on, you shouldn't be going on. But he asked me what I was going to do, and I said I would really, my dream would have been to go to Princeton and, you know, study theoretical physics there. And he said, oh, you know, to do that, you really have to be a genius, and, you know. And so I took that as discouragement. You know, it sort of meant I wasn't, or it would be too hard. Well, and I didn't go on.
Well, I think that your story is certainly very important in this overall question, because it points out the various cultural obstacles that you faced in entering this or trying to go into the sciences. But you do in the piece mention that the academic climate is more welcoming today, is it not?
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. So when I started writing my book, it was going to be my, say, a tale of woe from, you know, back in prehistoric times, being discouraged, not going on. And I really wanted to understand why I didn't go on. But I thought, well, let me follow up and see what's changed. And I went back to my high school. I went back to Yale, talked to young women. And I was shocked, especially at Yale, to find how little had changed in an atmosphere that did seem far more welcoming. Someone said to me, it doesn't matter how many of the women are in the room in as regards science, if each one still feels that she doesn't belong there. And I thought that was so perceptive, that the psychology of being a woman majoring in physics or math or engineering, really hadn't changed, even though there were more girls in the room, there were a few more female professors in the department. But each woman was still reporting all of the same psychological problems that I had experienced, and I found that remarkable.
Well, we'll talk more about those psychological experiences that women in science are experiencing still today with our guest, who wrote a piece in the New York Times, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science? And we're welcoming your answer to that question, your theory. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Eileen Pollack. She is a professor of English at the University of Michigan. She is working on a book about women in the sciences, and she is the writer of the piece, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science, that appeared recently in the New York Times. We have posted that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about women in science and why still today there are relatively, comparatively, so few women in the hard sciences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We would love to hear your story. Are you a woman or do you know a woman who's in a scientific field? What obstacles did you or did she encounter? What obstacles need to still be overcome? We welcome your input as we talk with the author of a recent New York Times piece on women in the sciences, Eileen Pollack. And our first caller is Laura in Madison. Hello, Laura.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned hard sciences. That's what I was calling about. I know that about half and probably very soon women will overtake men as graduates with medical degrees. And I know I have worked in the biotechnology field, and I know there are a lot of women in the biological sciences. My daughter-in-law has a PhD in microbiology, so it's not all science. And I also work in technology. I do know that there's a huge bias regarding women in technology, and it's pretty hard. There's a very, well, for example, I'm attending a conference right now in Madison, and out of a room of about 250 or so people, there are probably less than a half a dozen of us that are female.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Laura. So I guess I could have made that clear. Your piece specifically brings up what could be keeping women out of the STEM fields. The STEM fields are science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Although I should point out, I mean, the caller's point's well taken, but, you know, one of the studies that I cite, a very recent study, in the article is by a woman at Yale, biologist, as a matter of fact, named Jo Handelsman, and it documents bias against women in all the branches of the sciences, including biology. And it's very interesting because there was actually no difference between the bias against women in physics versus, say, biology. And what's interesting, that the women in biology or physics showed as much bias against the young women job candidates as the men did, and it didn't matter if you were young or old. And it was a very significant bias. They had the study involved sending out job applications from two mythical but completely equal candidates. One was named John and one was named Jennifer, but that was absolutely the only difference in the job application, which included a CV and letters, the cover letter and reference letters and all sorts of things. And Jennifer was much less likely to be hired, judged competent, or judged worthy of mentoring, yet she was judged more likable. And again, that was across the sciences and even in biology. So there may be more, you know, an equal number of women in biology, but are they getting grants? Are they getting the good jobs? There was a differential of $4,000. If Jennifer was going to be hired, she was going to be offered a salary $4,000 lower than John's, and these were fairly low salaries, so it's a big percentage. That said, I think there is a big difference in biology, theoretically, because women enjoy working with living things more than men do. But, you know, where does that come from? Is it inborn? Is it something we encourage in women? You know, not that long ago, women were seen as not being interested in biology. So if they had this deep love for plants and animals and things, why is it so recent that they're in biology? And, you know, women love music, but are living things involved in being a musician? No. So I think a lot of it is cultural. And if we can change the culture so that women believe they can be biologists, maybe we can change the culture so they'll think math is beautiful. In other countries, it's not seen as male or female to love math. It's seen as a very creative field, and women are creative. So, I mean, the caller's point is well taken, but I think it's easy to just see that on a surface level and not dig below and see what's really going on.
You also write in your piece, though, Yale in the fall of 2010 boasted that 30 to 40% of the undergraduates majoring in physics and physics-related fields were women. So that's progress or no?
Well, it is. You know, that's what I meant, that there were mm-hmm. more women in the room. But then the stories they told me were no different from the stories I would have told someone, you know, 35 years ago, that they had been teased in high school, made to feel unwelcome for taking, you know, a physics course, a calculus course, a computer science course, that they felt that boys didn't want to date them because they were in a physics class, or would they have to be more aggressive than they felt comfortable being to be a physicist. And what's interesting is that we're still losing women all along the way. So they're making it a little farther than they used to make it, but we're still losing many, many of those undergraduates between undergrad and either grad school or a career in industry. And then losing women in graduate school, losing them between graduate school and the first job, losing them before tenure. And so, you know, the pyramid has moved up a little from where my time, but that point at the top is still, you know, way too narrow. We're just losing women all along the way.
Yeah. And you talk about how the barriers are cultural.
Right.
There is no evidence that there's a difference between men and women when it comes to aptitude in terms of learning the sciences.
No, you know, and that's what one thing I do in the article is try to put that at rest. I don't think there's ever been, or at least in recent times, much of an argument about just the general population of men and women having equal aptitude in sciences and math. The question, I think, that Larry Summers raised, the president of Harvard, was whether at the very, very highest end of the spectrum, sort of the genius level, the level you would need to be to, say, become a physics professor at Harvard, whether there were differences up there. And I think some of the studies I cite in the article, and they're quite recent, put that to rest, that it's really cultural differences. In other countries, women are encouraged to be physicists, and they perform at that highest level. There are a good many reasons to believe that there's just no differences. And what small differences there are, say, in a kind of spatial ability that might affect your talent in the lab, if everybody, I mean, that's often a basis of experience. And so young men who come from, say, minority families where they haven't had the chance to, say, work on the family car in the backyard with the dad, sometimes also show that lack of experience. But if you have a course, say engineering schools have found this, if you have a course for all incoming engineers in how to like work in the lab and work with machines, within a few weeks, the differences just vanish between the genders. So no, it's cultural. What I think almost everybody agrees now, and studies again support this, is that a great deal of it is role modeling. That if you don't see women scientists, if you don't see scientists who are black or, you know, who just look like you, you don't think you can become one. That has a huge effect. I talk about the TV show The Big Bang Theory, which I think is it's a sitcom. It's a very popular sitcom, and it's very indicative of how in America, which isn't true of all cultures, we think of scientists as these very weird geeks. And I don't know what, I mean, not many American men are going on in the hard sciences, in the hard sciences. You know, they look at a show like The Big Bang Theory and think, why would I want to be like one of those guys?
Let me pick up on that point after we check the latest news. We have news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up next. And then we'll continue talking about why so few women go into the sciences. And we'll welcome your questions and your answers to that question as well. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about why so few women, even today, pursue careers in science. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Wednesday, October the 9th. Are you a woman who is in a scientific field? Were you encouraged or dissuaded to pursue science as a career? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Maybe you teach a class in science. What are you observing these days? Are you encouraging women to pursue science? Our guest is Eileen Pollack. She is a professor of English at the University of Michigan. She is the author of Breaking and Entering and In the Mouth. She is currently working on a third book about women in the sciences. She is also the writer of a recent piece in the New York Times, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science? She speaks from experience. She was one of the first two women to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in physics from Yale, but she did not pursue physics as a career. So we are talking about why that is and why some of these cultural barriers that she experienced still exist today. So, Eileen, we have a listener on Facebook who pointed out that half the women or half the scientists on the Big Bang Theory are women. I guess viewing this as a positive cultural example of women in the sciences. Yet just before news time, you were talking about the Big Bang Theory as not necessarily being a positive cultural, I guess, example. I don't know. I'm not familiar with that show at all. So why do you say what you say?
Well, it's about a group of scientists, most of them working at Caltech, who are, you know, very what we would call geeky. There's a woman who lives next door who is not a scientist. In fact, she's almost totally math and science illiterate, very pretty. She's struggling to be an actress. She's a waitress. And so the main contrast in the show when it premiered was between the four guys who are just such geeks, as our society would call them, and Penny next door, who's this very pretty blonde woman who has no ability at science and math. There was some pressure to add women scientists. There was a physicist first, and they didn't know what to do with her, so she sort of dropped off the show. So there are two women biologists who've been introduced. No, they're both biologists. One of them has this terrible voice, and she's sweet, but she was shown as working as a waitress to work her way through her PhD, which is completely unrealistic. She would be working in a lab. But also the other woman scientist, who's a neuroscientist, is shown to be just incredibly dumpy and unattractive. And what the irony is, in real life, the actress who plays her, Miriam Bialik, actually has a PhD in neuroscience.
Oh, boy.
And she's very attractive. So in other words, to meet the cultural stereotype of a woman scientist, even in biology, they had to make her look supremely dumpy and unattractive. There are no scientists of color anywhere on the show. And really, I can't imagine anybody who would want to be a scientist, anybody of either gender, who sees the show and thinks that's what scientists are. They're all unattractive. They all have terribly strange idiosyncrasies. And really, I don't know any scientists, actually male or female, who like the show. And the women scientists, I know, I just can't even watch it for 2 minutes.
I think Beth in Milwaukee, a caller, is going to agree with you. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Yeah, I actually resisted watching that show for a long time, and I started watching it, and immediately I knew that the blonde girl, I don't remember the character's name.
Penny.
But she, yeah, was kind of like the sex object. I mean, that's kind of a dated term. I don't know. You know, and these other girls were the scientists. It's just, it just kind of was very displeasurable.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you very much, Beth. We have an email from Thomas who says, cultural differences do have an effect, but the idea that anyone is discouraged from such careers under normal U.S. 21st century circumstances is absurd. What's your response to that?
I think most of the institutional barriers against women being in science are gone. They're illegal. I would say, first of all, that one difference I found between the genders is that even if nobody is encouraged to go on in science, which is a strange thing, that I found that it seems to be the ethos in the field that if you need to be encouraged, you shouldn't be there. Women need encouragement more than men. If a girl doesn't hear, you're good at this, you should go on, she takes that to mean you're no good at this, you shouldn't go on. Whereas guys are raised to not need that encouragement as much. I've been getting many emails from young men, older men, who say if only they had been encouraged, they would have gone on too. So it's not as if all men are just, you know, completely confident and don't need encouragement too. I think everybody does. But the way women are raised, they're raised to be modest, to underestimate their talents. They don't see many women in roles as scientists, so they're already at a disadvantage of not thinking they belong. And so when they don't get the encouragement, you know, they needed that extra boost. So that these are subtler differences than I think people give credit, but they really mount up. So if you're being teased, you're not being encouraged, you see that to be a woman in science and be taken seriously, you can't dress in a typically feminine way. And so that feeling that you have to dress down, you have to put on a sweatshirt and pants to go to the lab, or nobody's going to take you seriously, it just wears on you. And then if the work is difficult, you add child rearing into the equation, women might drop out along the way and not even realize that the odds have been stacked against them, that, you know, they might even say, well, it was my choice. I decided to stay home with my child at some point and leave my job in the lab. And then the male scientists say, see, women didn't really want to be scientists. They'd rather stay home. It's a choice. But if the, you know, if the going is harder, I like to say, if you're in the gym and you're on a treadmill and there's a man on the treadmill next to you and everything looks equal, and you can't figure out why you're sweating more and panting more, and you don't realize that the incline on your treadmill has been set higher than on his, and then you're each handed a ball to hold, and you don't even realize that yours is the heavier ball, and you just go, oh, you know, I don't know how he's doing it, but I can't do it. I choose to step off this treadmill. You know, it's not really a choice. Mm-hmm. It's not even a choice you might know that you're making. So I think that all along the way, these cultural differences, these cultural biases, these mount up. And if you don't realize, so again, that study where Jennifer was judged more likable, but then didn't get the job and got much lower pay. Gee, you think if you're Jennifer, everybody likes me. Mm-hmm. You don't realize why the job seems so much harder for you or why you didn't even get the job. And I think that's really what's mounting up. Can I just add one thing, too, with the notion that you can't be as feminine, that on the Big Bang Theory they make Amy, one of the scientists, look so dowdy. I think that's very true to life. And a lot of men I know sort of go, oh, really, that would bother women? And I want to say, you know, if you had to wear a dress to work as a man to be accepted and high heels and do your nails, that would really get in your way. You might not feel, you know, masculine the way you want to feel. You might drop out of that field. It is actually a very big thing. And one of the things I found is that women today, young girls, there are many more pressures to feel and look and act traditionally feminine than there were in the 70s when I went to school. There were not women walking around, undergrads walking around the Yale campus in heels and dresses and revealing tops and bearing their midriffs and planning fancy weddings. And I just think the culture has become ultra-feminized and sexualized in a way it actually wasn't so much in the 70s. So I think those factors all really add up.
Let me have you address Peter on Facebook, who writes, I think the fewer women in science question is because most women don't value careers in science. A double-digit percentage of women choose to raise children, which is a significant obstacle to success as a researcher, more so than other professional fields. Obviously, some women do choose scientific careers, and that's great. He says it's because women, are the mommy track, I guess.
Right. Well, and I was addressing some of that. First of all, I think he's right. I think women sometimes don't know that there are these great careers in science and computer science, and they're not being led to them. I've gotten many examples of girls who were steered away from, say, computer science courses in high school and college by their guidance counselors. One, because she was told she was kind of too pretty to be good in science and math. So that stuff is still going on. But again, this person on Facebook says that it's a choice. And even the women involved might say, well, I chose to stay home with my kids. But again, my analogy with the, you know, the Stairmasters or the treadmills, if you don't realize that you're meeting more bias and prejudice and not getting jobs and not getting the money, and that it's harder for you, and you've been putting up with these cultural barriers one by one by one, it feels harder. And then if you add child rearing onto that, it just becomes impossible. Was that your choice? Well, yes, only because it became intolerable for you to continue under conditions that are stacked against you. I don't see why the field has to be, why child rearing for either gender has to mean that you can't be a scientist. A, it's not true. There are women scientists who make it work. Why can't we have better daycare for everyone? There are more women scientists in France because it's more culturally acceptable, but also because there's better daycare. And because French scientists of both genders don't feel that you're going to be a better scientist just because you're in the lab 24/7, making yourself just mentally ill and having no kind of family life or ever enjoying anything about your life. Why does it have to be that way?
Let me jump in because we are at past a break time, but we will continue in just a moment. We are talking with Eileen Pollack, who has an academic background in science. She was one of the first two women ever to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in physics from Yale. But now she is a professor of English at the University of Michigan. We've been talking this hour about why she did not pursue a career in science and why so few women today pursue careers in science, talking about some of the cultural barriers that exist that prevent or discourage women from becoming scientists.
talking about her concern that only one-fifth of the people who have physics PhDs in this country are women. Only half of those women are American. And of all the physics professors in the U.S., only 14% are women. We're talking about why this is and what needs to be done to improve those statistics. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about why so few women still today pursue careers in science. And we're welcoming your questions and your thoughts on this. We have many callers waiting, so let me go to Paul in Middleton next. Hello, Paul.
Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
I'm calling because I have encouraged my children to pursue the science and mathematics. And I guess my eldest daughter in particular, who this November will be graduating from the University of Oxford with a master's in science in England. And, you know, she pursued a bachelor's of science in biology, a BA in chemistry, and a BA in environmental studies. And, you know, her experience at the undergraduate level was very supportive. It was a small liberal arts college. However, when she got to Oxford, of course, probably the cultural differences, all of the professors in her field were men. There was, of course, a tutorial system, and so not real hands-on involvement with the student. And I said, well, you know, and then now she's at a Scoville Fellowship at a think tank in Washington, D.C., but I've tried to tell her that, you know, you have to, at some point, feel or believe in your abilities and believe what you want to do. And if anybody gets in your way, or you just have to spit in their eye. And I'm sorry if I sound like I am from the East Coast, but I am. I'm not Midwest. Right? And you just have to just plow through them. And I said, you know, that's what you've got to do. You've got to be. And I know this sounds like an Alger hiss, and I'm talking about pulling yourself up by the bootstrap. I believe in meritocracy. I believe in mentoring. I believe in all those things. They're important. Especially in fields where it is collegiality that's supposed to rule. But, I mean, ultimately, if you really want it, you will not let anything stand in your way. You know, it's like T.E. Lawrence in the movie Lawrence Arabia. No prisoners. No prisoners.
All right. Well, what about that, Eileen?
Well, I'm totally with this caller. I think, yes, there are, you know, we need more mentoring, we need more lots of things, but we also need more dads and moms who say to their daughters at some point, it is about just believing in yourself. And some of the women, I finally found four women when I went back to Yale who had really made it through. They were postdocs. Well, one was a grad student. And they clearly were to go on. And I said, what makes you different? And they said, we're the women who don't give up. And I'll say damn for the radio audience.
It's
but
okay.
That there's a lot of that. You need other women to support it. But so much of it is just what this caller said, that it's psychological. And young women didn't used to be raised to hear this from their dads. I believe in you. You know, it's a tough world. You can do it. Go in there and don't let anybody stop you. And it's amazing how much difference that makes, that hearing that even from one person can make the difference for men as well, young men as well as young women, but young women need it more right now. And young science, you know, and young people of color. So yes, great. I think this caller is terrific.
Thank you, Paul. John in Richland Center is next. Hello, John.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
I have a comment, an observation. Do you remember Rachel Carlson?
Yes.
An excellent woman who made the Silent Spring book.
Mm-hmm.
And she pursued her career in, the 50s.
Right, and even before that.
Yeah, so what's your point then, Jen?
Well, my father was a science teacher, and I ended up to be a lab technician for GE Medical World Headquarters in the Computer Engineering Department for Magnetic Resonance Imaging. We all know about that. but I think we're wired differently.
Well, you know what? There's actually no proof that we're wired differently as far as, and there's a lot of proof to the contrary. And as a scientist, you should want to go by studies and not by your own conjecture. And the studies show that there is no biological difference in how men and women are wired as far as aptitude in the maths and sciences. I also think that just a few counterexamples of remarkable women like Rachel Carson don't disprove the law. They prove the larger claim. I mean, they're very few. Where are all the rest? Even Barbara McClintock, who was one of the most brilliant geneticists of the 20th century, if you read her biography, the put-downs, the disbelief, the sexism that she endured, it's a wonder that we have all the great discoveries about genetics that she came up with, because she did it only by being remarkably resilient. But so many other women, I've just been hearing from hundreds and hundreds of women who dropped out. They just had the talent, but they were discouraged. They were not encouraged.
Let's talk a little bit about why this matters, if women pursue careers in science or something else.
Well, I think that's a great question, Joy. And I think, first of all, it matters to the women who love the subject and would have wanted to go on, would love it if they were exposed to it more. And there are great jobs, there are great opportunities in the sciences, and they're missing out. But I think what's important to realize is that the country is missing out. We're desperately short of native-born scientists. Very few Americans of either gender are going on. And as somebody explained to me, if you need a certain number of scientists and you can only go to the barrel that holds men, male scientists in it, you are going to have to go much farther down toward the bottom of the barrel to get all the scientists and science teachers you need than if you had lots of barrels. You have a barrel full of male scientists, female scientists, scientists of color of both genders. You can take the top of the barrel from each barrel to fill the need. So the quality of scientists in America would go up if you could also be having equal numbers of female scientists, many more scientists of color. So it's important for the individuals who would enjoy these fields, be satisfied, have great jobs. And it's important for the country because these are the jobs that are going to help us move forward as a society.
Well, this has been really interesting. I want to thank you so much for being with us. And I hope when your book comes out, maybe we can do this again.
Oh, that would be lovely. Thanks for having me, Joy.
Eileen Pollack is a professor of English at the University of Michigan, and she is working on a book about women in the sciences. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing and directing this show. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Stay tuned for The Big Question. In our next hour, we'll have two guests from different political viewpoints talking about who is to blame for the government shutdown. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.